During the past decade, Cornell initiated the process of hiring a new generation of life scientists. And these hires were broadly distributed across five colleges: agricultural life sciences, arts and sciences, human ecology, engineering, and vet medicine. And they were spread across also 21 different departments. That includes the USDA's Robert W. Holly Center for Health and the Boyce Thompson Institute for Plant Research. So today it is my privilege, though, to be the moderator of the research presentations by three outstanding representatives of Cornell's next generation of life scientists. And you will hear from three junior faculty: Ruth Lay, Cynthia Reinhardt King, and Alex Travis. Now, while each of them offers a very exciting set of courses here at Cornell to our undergraduates that ranges from titles such as Microbes of the Human Body in Health and Disease to Nanobiotechnology to Conservation Medicine, today you're going to hear about these three individuals and what they bring to us in terms of cutting-edge methodologies and questions that involves our community of research faculty, graduate students, and undergraduates. You'll hear about how laboratory science here at Cornell on this campus leads to transformative discoveries of cellular and tissue function that will serve to enhance our ability to face head-on a wide range and wide spectrum of health and global challenges, ranging from how genes in the environment shape our propensity towards obesity, to visualizing the integrity of blood vessels in terms of the progression of atherosclerosis with age, to harnessing the very energy of reproduction to develop nanodevices that mimic basic biological functions. So I hope you will be able to share in the excitement of the work that these individuals carry here on campus, because the rest of us that are here on campus all the time get to enjoy that work and hear about it, and it's very exciting. So I'm going to ask that each of you hold your questions to the end of each individual's presentations, unless there's something you really need to have clarified immediately, all right? And then hopefully we'll have some time at the end for some additional questions, okay? So our first presenter, though, is going to be Ruth Lay. Ruth is in the Department of Microbiology.
Well, thank you very much. It's an honor to be here and tell you about some of the work that we've been doing here since I've come to Cornell. I'm in the Department of Microbiology, and I'm also adjunct in molecular biology and genetics, and I'm in the Center for Comparative and Population Genomics. And the fact that I'm in all of these things just shows how much we all come together across departments and work together to address some of these questions that we have. So when you were born, you left a womb that was sterile, and you came into a microbial world. And the microbes, which usually aren't this big, rapidly colonized your body and its surfaces and its internal surfaces, and to constitute what you have today, which is a very large assemblage of microbes. And our interest in this has peaked in the last 5 or 10 years as we start to understand their role in health. But we can really date interest in this system back to 1681, when van Leeuwenhoek actually invented the right technology to be able to first glimpse these organisms. He took a look at his own stool and noticed what we think is probably Giardia. But this was the first look. And since then, we've, as a field, and especially in the last 5 or 10 years, really built on this to understand now that we're a composite of human cells, but the microbial cells that coat our body surfaces are 10 times more numerous than our own human cells. And together, they encode genes that outnumber our own human genes by 150-fold. And so you can think of this as a second genome that you acquire from the outside. And how you acquire it and how it's assembled and what factors affect its composition are all things that we have a lot of interest in now, because it looks like they can also influence your health. And unlike your own genome, the microbes is something that you can actually potentially reprogram or shape to promote health. So the majority of the intestines on your body reside, sorry, this is a pretty wimpy pointer, in the large intestine, which is shown in red here. And that's the organ that we study mostly, the small intestine and the large intestine, where the microbes come in very close contact with your body. And it's here that they bring us many functions that we haven't had to evolve on our own. So they help us access more calories from food than we're able to access without their enzymatic properties. They help degrade otherwise toxic compounds. They actually supply us with vitamins as well. And we're also coming to understand that they interact closely with our immune system. They prime our immune system. They might have something to do with allergic responses and autoimmune disease development, and so a wide variety of different aspects of our health and biology. And what we've been focusing on in my lab is how they've come to influence our latest incarnation here. We know that we've co-evolved with these microbes, and now we're wondering how they're playing into the obesity epidemic that we're experiencing today. So to study gut microbes, we use mouse models. And what I want to leave you with today is that we've recently found that there's two very distinct and separate ways that gut microbes can actually influence body weight. So this is one mouse model of obesity, the OBOB mouse, and I'll start with that one. So when you go out for lunch and you choose couscous salad, for instance, you might think that there's 200 calories per serving because that's what it says on the label. But that's something that was developed from taking this product and burning it and seeing how much heat was released. In the human body, this type of food goes into the large intestine, and there the microbes release the energy from it via fermentation. So the composition of that assemblage of gut microbes is a factor in how much energy is released. So that even though you might get 200 calories out of that serving, somebody else sitting next to you might get 220 or might get 190, for example, depending on the functions and the composition of that microbial community. And the way we've been able to ascertain this type of finding is by using germ-free animals. So we can raise animals in these isolators so that they have no microbes whatsoever on their in their guts. And then we can give them specific assemblages, and then we can see what that does. We can see that certain mice get fatter depending on what types of gut microbes they've received. So for instance, if these would all be the animals living in the sterile isolators, they're genetically normal, and then we can give them the gut microbes from a lean donor or the gut microbes from an obese donor, and the ones that receive microbes from obese donors have twice the increase in body weight than those that get the microbes from the lean donors. And this is some of the work we're following up on now. There's another completely different way that microbes can influence body weight that we've been working on since I've come to Cornell. And this is another type of obese mouse. It happens to have a defect in its immune system. It lacks toll-like receptor 5, which is something that that the body uses to detect motile bacteria. And these animals eat a lot more than their wild-type counterparts. So this shows their food intake. They eat more, and that's why they're fat. If you give these animals antibiotics, they, in both cases, whether they're normal or mutants, you reduce the bacterial load in the gut. But what that actually does is that those that used to eat more, now they eat less. So it reduces their food intake. And they end up thinner, of course. So we have an animal that normally would become quite overweight. We give it antibiotics, and it doesn't gain the weight. And this very much implicates the gut microbes in this in the weight gain here. Also, we can take the gut microbiota from that mutant animal and transplant them into those germ-free animals. And just like the other case I told you about, if mice receive their microbes from the fat donors, they will become fatter. That shows their fat pad weights, or the these areas of the mouse's body where they pack on the weight. And again, the only difference between these animals was where they got their gut microbes from. So you can actually transfer metabolic syndrome and obesity to an otherwise normal, genetically normal animal by transferring the microbiota. And we study these gut microbial communities. We try to understand their functions and what types of microbes are there. We use next generation sequencing. So for instance, the Illumina HiSeq, the Roche 454. So it's technology intensive. We use different sequencing platforms, and then we go through computational steps. And so our major approach to understanding what's going on is through sequencing the genes. And I thought I'd mention, if you've ever wondered why this instrument is called the 454, it's the temperature at which your money burns when you're actually using this. So these are also cash-intensive approaches, but it's a way of discovering what's going on inside these animals, and we also apply the same techniques to humans and to human samples as well at the same time. So what I've shown you very, very briefly is that we know at least of two ways in which the microbes in your gut contribute to body weight. They can modulate the amount of energy that's extracted from a given food. And in the second case, what we know is happening is the microbes are actually triggering a low-grade inflammation. So obesity is also it's a state in which there's inflammation throughout the body. And what we think is happening is that the microbes can trigger inflammation, and that triggers insulin resistance. And once insulin resistance sets in, then there's a number of other symptoms of metabolic syndrome, ranging from high blood pressure to trouble handling glucose to trouble handling lipids that comes in. And so we know that we can take a perfectly normal animal and induce metabolic syndrome by just transferring gut microbes. And now the challenge is to understand whether certain people are predisposed to developing symptoms of metabolic syndrome from the types of gut microbes that inhabit them, and if we can use the gut microbiota as a target in therapy for this. So the major questions we're addressing in my lab is how can we reshape the gut microbiome to promote health? We're very interested also in how variation in the human genome relates to variation in the microbiome. So in other words, if we know that certain aspects of human genetics predispose people to certain diseases, how does that interact with the microbiota as well to predispose people to chronic inflammation diseases? And finally, what are we going to have for lunch? This is important too, because it's an everyday choice. As you leave here, you might want to order the garden salad, but in fact, your gut microbes have a different idea, and we know that they can influence behavior. When we give them to a certain mouse and that mouse eats more, that's a way in which the gut microbes are ultimately influencing behavior. So there's still a lot to find out in this field, and Cornell's a great place to be doing it. This is my lab group at Cornell. These are my students and postdocs who are very wonderful to work with, and I thought I'd point out the undergraduates that we have. We have terrific undergraduates who come and they work one-on-one with my graduate students and postdocs who come from around the country and around the world. And so it's definitely a two-way street with the undergraduates, where they actually help us with our primetime research, and by having active research groups, I think we also really round out the educational experience of the undergrads who come and join our labs. And finally, I'd like to thank the people who support the work. I've benefited tremendously from early career opportunities, and I think Cornell's been a terrific place to make that happen. And so I've had much more success here than I ever really dreamed just in the first few years. So it's been a terrific place. Thank you very much.